We are joined by Councilperson David Grosso. He is an at-large member of the DC City Council, so he's not restricted to any particular jurisdiction here. He's elected by all of us. He's a DC native, which is a pretty rare thing, frankly, and yet he spent a lot of time on a farm in Virginia. This is the first hint. He graduated from Earlham with a degree in philosophy. That's your second hint. And he went to Georgetown Law School, where I think Keith Stropp went to school as well. He's well-traveled. He spent a lot of time outside of the country in Honduras and helping the poor in San Antonio. That's your fourth hint, that David is a really genuine person regarding how he has gotten to his stature in politics. He worked for a city councilwoman for years, Sharon Ambrose, who was very progressive, and later Eleanor Holmes Norton, our congresswoman, and is a stalwart in the civil rights movement in the United States. I was in a meeting with her one time where the head of the ACLU was there, Ira Glasser, and Ira Glasser told the story of how he hired Eleanor Holmes Norton in the 1970s, and the very first case he assigned her was to represent racists down in the South. And I've been on many panels with Eleanor Holmes Norton, and we hope someday she enjoys the full vote of a congresswoman. Mr. Grosso is bright, to say the least. He's energetic. His policy making is clear right from the beginning what things matter to him in his ascendancy. And we're blessed to have him here to share part of our day. There are 535 members of Congress. And that's a pretty unwieldy group. But I would ask, would anybody here like to take a guess how many state legislators there are? And I think of Mr. Grosso as a state legislator. Anybody? 7,800 state politicians. So at normal, we have to work with hundreds, if not thousands, of state politicians. And when I wrote to David asking him whether he could speak today, I wanted him to know that of the many thousands of state politicians we've worked with, we have never seen one come out of the gate as strong and full-voiced for marijuana law reform than David. When he got elected in 2012, you would not think it was one of his major priorities, but he certainly made it so in the ensuing years on the committee. He's championed medical marijuana here in town. There are about 3,000 registered patients. There are 3 dispensaries here in town. He's trying to get emergency legislation passed to get another cultivation center going because we don't have enough supply here. Decriminalization began July 1st of 2014, and David was also a champion of that. And of course, we know here in the district, voters like myself voted at the 70th percentile to legalize marijuana, but the term I think more properly employed earlier was depenalize marijuana. But David has argued strongly that we need legalization. It's kind of the obvious next step, and has helped with the other with the mayor and the city council to stave off Congress from stopping the implementation of these laws. So we've asked David here to come and talk about why he gives such a high priority to this, why DC voters likely at the 70 percentile support legalization and marijuana law reform. But I guess my strong point I want to make here in bringing David up is that I can literally think of a few politicians who in their ascendancy supported legalization. I can name you dozens to hundreds who in their descendancy out of politics, when there was going to be no more vote, when they were not going to raise any more money, when they're not going to get before the cameras. One can think about Bill Clinton, right? The first interview he gave when he left the presidency was to Jan Wenner at Rolling Stone. And Jan called up and he says, listen, I have this interview with the president. I want to ask him some drug-related questions. And so we helped formulate a question, which was like, more people were arrested on your watch than at any other time as a president, more than Nixon. So what is your view post-presidency on marijuana? And he said, oh, I think it should be decriminalized. He was the president for 8 years. He fought every aspect of marijuana law reform. And more contemporary, think about Barbara Boxer, awesomely powerful senator from Colorado, from California, but only when she declared that she was not going to run did she finally come out in favor of major drug policy reform. We don't have to worry about that with David. From the very beginning, he has been a clear voice. And when he's done with his remarks, we have an award for him, and we'll talk a little bit about that award. Thank you, David, for coming and speaking here today. David Grosso, DC City Council.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Alan. You pretty much covered everything, so, you know, I mean. You know, it's interesting. I have to run for re-election next year, so you're making me a little nervous. Maybe I, you know, should have waited until the after my second term to actually come out on this. You know, I didn't really want to come out and work on this issue. In fact, I knew all along in my life and the experiences that I've had in my life that it was important to do, and I knew that it was necessary for our country to move past prohibition of marijuana and drugs in our country. I knew that the war on drugs had failed, and I knew that it was time for us to move to a new place here. But I had other priorities. I was hoping to be fully engaged on education issues and on health and human services issues, which are so important to the people of our city. And now I am the chair of the Committee on Education, so I'm able to do that, and I'm really proud of that. The reason why I ended up coming out and trying to get marijuana legalized and move forward with a tax and regulate plan here in the District of Columbia is a little bit complicated, but I want to let you all know a little bit why I did it. Like I said, I didn't start out wanting to do this. You can ask my staff. I did it resistingly, but in the spring of my first year in office, which would have been 2013, I went out to Patuxent State Prison in Maryland. And got to participate in the program called the Alternative to Violence Program, which was put on there by a group, mostly Quakers, but some other folks, where we spent 3 days in a maximum security prison with about 30 inmates, learning what it was like to really practice nonviolence in a setting like that, which is, as you can imagine, an extremely violent setting. They've been doing that for 25 plus years in this prison. So for me, it was an opportunity to learn what it's like to go to jail, what it's like to be dealing with those kinds of issues every day. And you know, this program was interesting, but the kind of point that I took away with it, one of the points was that of the 25 or so inmates that were running this program, the average age was about 22, 23, and almost all of them were nonviolent drug offenders. They were not violent, robberies or murder or things like that. And most of them were serving more than 10 years for three strikes, you're out stuff. So this was not a, this was a real thing for these folks. And so that was something that impacted me. Then following that, I read Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow book. And if you think about the, you know, kind of the incredible amount of effort that's been put into putting people behind bars in this country over the past 20, 30, 40 years, and then you read her book and you see how unjust it is and how unfair it is across the board, you begin to have to reflect on that. You have to think, well, if you're in a position of power, what do you have to do to change that? And then further in that summer, the ACLU and the Washington Lawyers Committee came out with a study in the District of Columbia that noted that 91% of everyone that was arrested for nonviolent marijuana offenses were people who are African Americans in our city, even though it was equal 50-50 people who actually smoked marijuana in the District of Columbia. So if you put those things together, you start to realize why when I thought about how I was going to have an impact on that, there was really only one answer to that, and that was to try to put a program in place that would tax and regulate marijuana just like alcohol in the district and ultimately send fewer and fewer people to jail. We did then introduce that bill, my staff and I did, in the September of that year, and I was the only one on it. So I think that's an interesting timeline kind of snippet there. I couldn't get any of my colleagues to join me. None of them co-sponsored it on the dais. It was just me on the bill. We were in the midst of, and I'll give credit to my colleague Tommy Wells and others who were working on decriminalization and had started doing that earlier the year. So some of them didn't get on it because they thought decrim would be enough. I even though I made the argument that in the end, you know, we really have to regulate it and stop sending everybody to jail for this stuff. So we moved forward from there, and you know, the kind of the history, Initiative 71 passed, and I was really grateful to the work that was done on that because it elevated the conversation and allowed me to go out in the community and continue to educate on this issue and to continue to talk to the community and talk to the neighbors. One thing that I know is that when I talk to folks for more than 10 minutes, they always, almost always, I say, agree that we should stop the prohibition on marijuana in the District of Columbia. I think the vote was indicative of this with 71%. But I think also, if you just talk to the grandmothers who have children that have gone to jail for nonviolent drug offenses, or the brothers and sisters that have had their brothers and sisters go to jail for this, you start to realize that it's pervasive, especially in the poorest of the poor communities in the District of Columbia, and that the only alternative we have really to get out of that quagmire was to go ahead and regulate it like we do alcohol. So we introduced it, and we had some hearings on it, but more than anything, I was able to get out into the community and talk to people and really engage on these forums. There was a few people that would be put on the panels with me, as you can imagine, that were very against this, and the arguments just didn't stand up anymore. You know, the reality is that the war on drugs has failed, and that it's time for us to move forward to a new place. So I also, and I just want to note one other bill I introduced at the same time that I think is just as important. This bill would seal the records of anyone who has had a nonviolent marijuana offense in the past in the District of Columbia. This is the only jurisdiction where we've done this. That bill passed unanimously and is now law in the District of Columbia. So if you had a misdemeanor or felony nonviolent offense in the District of Columbia in the past, you know, I felt like it'd be uncool to just let it go forward. I couldn't quite let you out of jail because our inmates are in the Bureau of Prisons in the federal system, as you know, probably, maybe you don't, but we don't have a local jail system or prison system in D.C., so our inmates, once you get sentenced to a long term, go on to Colorado and California and other places, and it'd be very hard to get them to come back, although some did that back in the day when we changed the sentencing disparities for crack and powder cocaine. We were able to get some folks released early, which I think would be important here if we could do it. But since we can't do it, as soon as you get out of jail for a nonviolent offense, you can go down to the court, and we're able to do a little different than expungement. We were able to put the law in place so that the court has the burden to prove why you shouldn't have your record sealed. And your record is sealed all the way through your arrest record, not just your court proceeding or your court case. So this is a real effort to try to make it so people can go on to a higher education, can get jobs, can get public housing in the District of Columbia. This is in effect right now in the district, and we are slowly rolling out our plan to advertise it. So I hope you guys will keep that in mind. I want to note the reason why we don't have tax and regulate in D.C., and I think it's important for you guys, since you're going to be going up to the Hill tomorrow, and I hope that you'll keep us in mind while you're up there. The only reason why the District of Columbia doesn't have tax and regulate is because we don't have full voting rights, and we're the only jurisdiction in the country. We have 650,000 residents who do not have a vote in Congress. We do not have two senators. We do not have a voting member of the House. Alan mentioned Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's our non-voting member of the House. She has a lot of the same rights, but she can't vote on final bills. When I worked with her, we got her a vote in the Committee of the Whole, which is the step right before the House votes on things, which was a big deal. They had Democrats were in charge, and they gave her that Committee of the Whole. But even the Democrats told her and put in the rules, unless it's a tie. So her vote was essentially meaningless even then. So what we need, it'd be fine. Like, you know, I would love to have two senators. I would love to be a state and everything. But we can manage. We have balanced budgets for the past 18 years. We can manage without it, except for the fact that they like to meddle in our business on a regular basis. So whether it's, you know, reproductive health issues, gun issues, drug issues, a great example, and I don't mean to ramble on here, but a great example is the needle exchange program. I don't know if any of you know what this is, but it's a program that gives you a clean needle if you're an addict, should try to stop the spread of diseases between intravenous drug users. The District of Columbia for years was prohibited by Congress from implementing that with not just federal money, but also our local money. And so, you know, our spread of HIV and Hep C went on and on and on because we couldn't implement this, even though we knew in places like Baltimore and other places this was an extremely effective methodology. Ironically, we are allowed to do it now with our local money, not our federal money, but ironically, Governor Pence, who is the governor of Indiana, used to be in Congress, and he was one of the ones that fought on this really intently and constantly put riders on our budget that would stop us from spending our own money on this health initiative, now has an enormous problem, an epidemic in the state of Indiana with the spread of Hep C and HIV, and he is now having to adopt the needle exchange program in Indiana because he realizes that it works. Now, they put all these things on us, and, you know, ultimately, what happens is it's a small minority of folks that make it their number one issue. So we have folks up on the Hill that think that we are, a petri dish of some sort, that they can try out issues on us or gain credit in other places. For example, Marco Rubio, who's running now, right before he announced he was going to run for office, he introduced a bill that said in Congress that said that all D.C. gun laws are, totally wiped clean. There's no D.C. gun laws. And so he didn't get it passed, but that was a little thing for the NRA to say, you know what, there's not going to be any gun laws. I'll fight for that. The only reason he did that in D.C. is because in Florida they already have that. So he couldn't actually go and make that happen in Florida, so he just did it here in D.C. to get more points. That's what they've done with marijuana now. So we have some of these knuckleheads that are up there on the Hill that are trying to intervene on us with our drug policy in spite of the facts, in spite of the reality that sending people to jail doesn't make any difference here and that it only makes things worse. In spite of the reality that the majority of the people that are arrested prior to decriminalization and prior to Initiative 71 were African Americans, and that continues today when it comes to where do you buy your drugs. You buy your marijuana, some people can get somebody to come to their house and perhaps that's safe, but when you're an African American selling it on the street, you're still arrested for it. And so until we get full regulation of marijuana, we haven't won. Until we get to the point where we have stores that can be put in place that can help make sure that it's not sold to minors, that can help make sure that people who need help can get help and make sure that, in the end, no one's getting arrested with an underground market. Until then, we haven't really won. So I reintroduced the bill in spite of Congress in January. My staff and I then had to go on a list up to the congressional committee where we were a little nervous at first, but then we realized they don't have any power. So it didn't bother us that much, right, Christina? I mean, right. Well, in the end, they can come down on us, and they have. And they said that we're not allowed to spend any time or money on the regulation of marijuana in the District of Columbia. That's a rider on our budget that they passed in December. We will wait, and hopefully in September, when they have to do the next budget, that they can take that rider off of there. And that's what I'd be asking you guys to politely mention when you're lobbying, is that just go in and say, can you please not support a rider being put on D.C.'s budget so the people of the District of Columbia can have their desire respected, and their desire is to stop the war on drugs in D.C. and to move forward with full legalization in the nation's capital. So with that, I want to thank you all for having me here today. I want to thank you for coming here and doing this. It's not every day that folks take time out of their busy lives to come down and lobby Congress, and I think it is important. I think if nothing else, it'll lock in some folks that can understand what the issues are across the country. It wasn't hard for me to make this decision because of all the things that I told you about, but ultimately, it's also not hard for me because I believe it's the right thing to do. And everything I do up here is based in some human rights framework and some justice framework, and I believe wholeheartedly that expanding the jails and putting more people in jails is the wrong thing to do, and I'm going to continue to fight against that for as long as I'm an elected official. So thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and to be fair, he was very equitable. When he says they, what he's really talking about are Republicans. And so here in D.C., since it hews so very strongly Democratic, and I'm only speaking analytically or not in a partisan way, it is only when Republicans are in control of Congress that they meddle with D.C. government. So looking forwardly, David and his peers will likely have success only when Republicans are not in control of the Congress. So this is our Rufus King Senior Award for Outstanding Public Leadership. It's been received by a number of politicians around the country. I think from what you heard today from David, you can just imagine how quickly marijuana law reform would happen around the country if our state legislatures and city councils were populated with men and women like himself. And as I suggested in my remarks, I think that is happening. It's a fait accompli. It's called demographics. So Rufus King was one of Normal's first board members. He was the original marijuana activist in the 1950s and 60s. He got pinball legalized in the United States. And he was a fascinating guy. He really was. And so we make this award in his name, and we make it in 2015 to the District of Columbia councilperson, David Grosso.